This is Audible.
The Colour of Magic. See, great Tatooine the turtle comes, swimming slowly through the interstellar gulf, hydrogen frost on his ponderous limbs, his huge and ancient shell pocked with meteor craters. Through sea-sized eyes that are crusted with rheum and asteroid dust, he stares fixedly at the destination. In a brain bigger than a city, with geological slowness, he thinks only of the weight. Most of the weight is, of course, accounted for by Beryllia, Tubal, Great Typhon, and Jerakeen, the four giant elephants upon whose broad and star-tanned shoulders the disk of the world rests. The Great Turtle was a mere hypothesis until the day the small and secretive kingdom of Kurul, whose rimmost mountains project out over the rimfall, built a gantry and pulley arrangement at the tip of the most precipitous crag, and lowered several observers over the edge in a quartz-windowed brass vessel to peer through the mist veils. The early astrozoologists, hauled back from their long dangle by teams of slaves, were able to bring back much information about the shape and nature of Atuin and the elephants, but this didn't resolve fundamental questions about the nature and purpose of the universe. For example, what was Atuin's actual sex? This vital question, said the astrozoologists, wouldn't be answered until a larger and more powerful gantry was constructed for a deep space vessel. In the meantime, they could only speculate about the revealed cosmos. There was, for example, the theory that Atuin had come from nowhere and would continue at a steady gait into nowhere for all time. An alternative was that Atuin was crawling from the birthplace to the time of mating, as were all the stars in the sky, which were, obviously, also carried by giant turtles. When they arrived, they would briefly and passionately mate for the first and only time, and from that fiery union, new turtles would be born to carry a new pattern of worlds. This was known as the Big Bang hypothesis. Thus it was that a young cosmocolonian of the Steady Gate faction, testing a new telescope with which he hoped to make measurements of the precise albedo of Great Atuin's right eye, was on this eventful evening the first outsider to see the smoke rise hubward from the burning of the oldest city in the world. Fire roared through the bifurcated city of Ankh Morpork. By now, the whole of downtown Morpork was alight, and the richer and worthier citizens of Ankh, on the far bank, were bravely responding to the situation by feverishly demolishing the bridges. But already, sparks were riding the breeze and touching down far across the river. The smoke from the merry burning rose miles high in a wind-sculpted black column that could be seen across the whole of the Discworld. It was certainly impressive from the cool, dark hilltop a few leagues away, where two figures were watching. The taller of the pair was chewing on a chicken leg and leaning on a sword that was only marginally shorter than the average man. His partner was much shorter and wrapped from head to toe in a brown cloak. Later, when he has occasion to move, it'll be seen that he moves lightly, cat-like. The big man stirred.
Weasel?
Yes?
I wonder who started it.
The small man said nothing. He was watching the road in the ruddy light. He'd made out the shapes of two mounted men and some sort of low beast behind them. Doubtless a rich merchant escaping with as much treasure as he could lay frantic hands on. The weasel said as much to his companion, who shifted his grip on his sword, and as the leading rider drew near, stepped out onto the road with his face set in a grin, nicely calculated to reassure, yet threaten.
"Your pardon, sir,"
he began. The rider reined in his horse and drew back his hood. The big man looked into a face blotched with superficial burns and punctuated by tufts of singed beard. "Bugger off," said the face. "You're Bravd the Hublander, aren't you?" Bravd became aware that he'd fumbled the initiative. That goes for your shadow-loving flea-bag partner, too, wherever he's hiding. The weasel stepped up to the horse and peered at the dishevelled figure.
Why, it's Rincewind the Wizard, isn't it? I thought I recognised the voice.
Bravt spat and sheathed his sword. Wizards rarely had any treasure worth speaking of. The weasel pointed toward the burning city.
You've been through that.
The wizard rubbed a red raw hand across his eye. See him? Back there? He pointed back down the road, to where his travelling companion was still approaching, having adopted a method of riding that involved falling out of the saddle every few seconds.
Well,
said Weasel.
He started it.
Bravd and Weasel looked at the figure, now hopping across the road with one foot in a stirrup.
Fire Razor, is he?
Said Bravd at last.
Nah, said Rincewind.
Not precisely. Got any food?
There's some chicken, said Weasel, in exchange for a story.
What's his name?
Said Bravd. Twoflower, said Rincewind, dismounting. There was a scream from the roadway, cut off abruptly. One of the things he can't do, he can't ride a horse, Rincewind said. Then he dashed into the gloom. When he returned, the being called Twoflower was hanging limply over his shoulder. It was small and skinny, and dressed in a pair of knee-length breeches and a shirt in such a violent and vivid conflict of colours that Weasel's fastidious eye was offended even in the half-light. Bravd winked at the weasel and went to investigate the shape that they assumed was a pack animal.
You'd be wise to forget it, said the wizard without looking up from his examination of the unconscious Twoflower.
Believe me, a power protects it.
A spell?
Said Weasel, squatting down.
No, but magic of a kind, I think.
Not the usual sort. Stronger than you, Bravd. It is, I think, more cunning even than you, Weasel. Bravd looked at the shape on the road. It was closer now, and clearer in the pre-dawn light. It looked for all the world like a...
A box on legs?
He said. I'll tell you about it, said Rincewind. If there's any wine, that is. Several days before these events, a ship came up the Ankh on the dawn tide and fetched up in the maze of wharves and docks on the Moorpork shore. It carried a cargo of pink pearls, milk nuts, pumice, and a man. It was the man who engaged the attention of Blind Hugh, one of the beggars on early duty at Pearl Dock. He nudged Cripple Wah in the ribs and pointed. The stranger was standing on the quayside, watching several straining seamen carrying a large brass-bound chest down the gangplank. When the chest had been deposited on the cobbles, the stranger reached into a pouch, and there was the flash of a coin. Several coins. Gold. Blind Hugh, his body twanging like a hazel rod in the presence of water, whistled to himself. Then he nudged Wah again and sent him scurrying off down a nearby alley. Blind Hugh snatched up his begging cup and made his way across the street with an ingratiating leer.
"Good day to thee, sire,"
he began, and found himself looking up into a face with four eyes in it. He froze. The stranger quickly thumbed through a small black book he'd taken from his belt. Then he said,
"Hello."
"Hello yourself,"
Hugh riposted. The stranger smiled widely and fumbled yet again in the pouch. This time his hand came out holding a large gold coin. It was, in fact, slightly larger than the $8,000 Ankhian crown, and the design on it was unfamiliar, but it spoke inside Hugh's mind in a language he understood perfectly. The stranger consulted the small book again.
"I wish to be directed to an hotel, a tavern, lodging house, inn, hospice, caravanserai."
"What, all of them?" said Hugh. "Look, I know a good tavern. Is that enough?"
He shuddered to think of the gold coin escaping from his life, and the big chest that comprised most of the newcomer's luggage looked to be full of gold, Hugh decided. The four-eyed man looked at his book.
"I wish to be directed to an hotel, tavern, lodge..."
"Come on, then," said Hugh, and set off.
When he glanced back, the little man was ambling along in the middle of the street, looking around him with an expression of keen interest. Something else Hugh saw nearly made him gibber. The massive wooden chest was following on its master's heels with a gentle rocking gait. Hugh bent slightly so that he could see under the chest. There were lots and lots of little legs.
"Odd," said Emor.
"He had this big wooden chest,"
added Cripplewar.
"He'd have to be a merchant or a spy," said Emor. "What do you think, Withel?"
Opposite Emor, the second greatest thief in Ankh-Morpork half-closed his one eye and shrugged. There was a flutter of wings at the window. Emor shifted his bulk out of the chair and crossed the room, coming back with a large raven. After he'd unfastened the message capsule from its leg, it flew up to join its fellows lurking among the rafters.
"B-12,"
said Emor, tossing the little file aside and unrolling the tiny scroll within.
"He says Hugh has taken our stranger to the Broken Drum."
There were few people in the Broken Drum to watch blind Hugh and Two Flower descend the stairs. When the luggage appeared behind them and started to lurch confidently down the steps, the customers at the rough wooden tables, as one man, looked suspiciously at their drinks. Broadman was browbeating the small troll who swept the bar when the trio walked past him.
"What in hell's that?" he said.
"Just don't talk about it,"
hissed Hugh. Twoflower was already thumbing through his book.
"I wish for an accommodation, a room, lodgings, the lodging house, full board. Are your rooms clean, a room with a view? What is your rate for one night?"
Broadman looked at Hugh. The beggar shrugged.
"He's got plenty of money," he said.
"Tell him it's 3 copper pieces, then, and that thing will have to go in the stable."
Broadman held up 3 thick red fingers, and the man's face was suddenly a sunny display of comprehension. He reached into his pouch and laid 3 large gold pieces in Broadman's palm. Broadman stared at them. They represented about 4 times the worth of the Broken Drum, staff included. He swallowed. All eyes in the room were watching the stranger, except for a pair belonging to Rincewind the Wizard, who was sitting in the darkest corner nursing a mug of very small beer. He was watching the luggage.
"Watch Rincewind. Look at him."
Scrawny, like most wizards, and clad in a dark red robe on which a few mystic sigils were embroidered in tarnished sequins, around his neck was a chain bearing the bronze octagon that marked him as an alumnus of Unseen University, the High School of Magic. Graduates were usually destined for maidship at least, but Rincewind, after an unfortunate event, had left knowing only one spell and made a living of sorts around the town by capitalising on an innate gift for languages. He put his acquaintances in mind of a bright rodent, and he knew Sapient Pearwood when he saw it. He was seeing it now and didn't quite believe it. An archmage, by dint of great effort and much expenditure, might eventually obtain a small staff made from the timber of the sapient pear tree. It grew only on the sites of ancient magic. There were probably no more than 2 such staffs in all the cities of the Circle Sea. A large chest of it. Rincewind tried to work it out, and decided that even if the box were crammed with star opals and sticks of auriculatum, the contents wouldn't be worth 1/10 the price of the container. He stood up and made his way to the trio. "May I be of assistance?"
"Shove off, Rincewind," snarled Broadman.
"I only thought it might be useful to address this gentleman in his own tongue," said the wizard gently. He smiled politely at the stranger and tried a few words of Shimmeran, but the stranger only looked bemused. Rincewind switched to High Borogravian, to Vanglishmet, Sumtri, and even Blackarugu. Each was met with polite incomprehension. In desperation, he tried Heathen Trob, and the little man's face split into a delighted grin.
"At last," he said, "my good sir, this is remarkable.
although in Trob the last word in fact became a thing which may happen but once in the usable lifetime of a canoe, hollowed diligently by axe and fire from the tallest diamond-wood tree that grows in the forests on the slopes of Mount Awayawa, home of the fire gods, or so it is said. Rincewind swallowed. "Broadman," he said, "two mugs of your best ale, please."
"You can understand him?"
"Oh, sure."
Tell him he's very welcome. Tell him breakfast is, one gold piece."
"Stranger," said Rincewind levelly in Trob, "if you stay here, you will be knifed or poisoned by nightfall. But don't stop smiling, or so will I."
"Oh, come now," said the stranger, looking around. "This looks like a delightful place, a genuine Morporkian tavern. I've heard so much about them, you know. All these quaint old beams, and so reasonable, too."
Rincewind glanced around quickly, in case some leakage of enchantment from the magician's quarter across the river had momentarily transported them to some other place. Nah, this was still the interior of the drum, its walls stained with smoke, its floor a compost of old rushes and nameless beetles, its sour beer not so much purchased as hired for a while. The visitor went on, "My name is Twoflower," and extended his hand. "Pleased to meet you," said Rincewind. "I'm Rincewind. Look, I wasn't joking. This is a tough place."
"Good! Exactly what I wanted."
"Eh?
What is this stuff in the mugs?"
"This? Beer. Thanks, Broadman. Yeah, beer, you know."
"Beer? Ah, the so typical drink. A small gold piece will be sufficient payment, do you think? I don't want to cause offence."
croaked Rincewind. "I mean, no, it won't cause offence."
"Good. You say this is a tough place. Frequented, you mean, by heroes and men of adventure?"
Rincewind considered this.
Yes. "Excellent! I would like to meet some."
"You've come to hire mercenaries?"
"Oh, no! I just want to meet them, so that when I get home, I can say that I did it."
Rincewind thought that a meeting with most of the drum's clientele would mean that Twoflower never went home again, unless he lived downriver and happened to float past. "Where is your home?" he inquired.
"Have you heard of the city of Bez Pelagic?"
"Well, I didn't spend much time in Trob. I was just passing through, you know."
"Oh, it's not in Trob. I speak Trob because there are many Betrobi sailors in our ports. Bez Pelagic is the major seaport of the Agatian Empire. You sail turnwise from the Brown Islands for about a week, and there it is. Are you all right?"
Rincewind had choked on his beer. The stranger came from the counterweight continent, small but equal in weight to all the mighty land masses in its hemicircle. Why so? Because it's largely made of gold. Rincewind pinched himself and listened open-mouthed as Twoflower talked.
"So I decided to see for myself," the little man was saying. "8 years saving up this has cost me, but worth every half rhino. I mean, here I am, in Ankh Morpork, famed in song and story, I mean, in the streets that have known the tread of Herrick Whiteblade, Harun the Barbarian, braved the Hublander and the Weasel. It's just like I imagined, you know."
Rincewind's face was a mask of fascinated horror.
"I just couldn't stand it any more back in Bez Pelagic," Twoflower went on blithely. "Sitting at a desk all day, just adding up columns of figures. Where's the romance in that? Twoflower, I thought, it's now or never. So I bought a passage on the next ship to the Brown Islands."
"No guards?" murmured Rincewind.
"No, why?"
"You have, gold."
"Barely 2,000 rhino. Hardly enough to keep a man alive for more than a month or two. At home, that is. I imagine they might stretch a bit further here."
"Would a rhino be one of those big gold coins?" said Rincewind.
"Yes. Will 2,000 be sufficient, do you think?"
croaked Rincewind. "I mean, yes, sufficient."
An idea occurs to me. Rincewind, would you perhaps consent to be employed as a, I don't know, perhaps the word guide would fit the circumstances? I think I could afford to pay you a rhino a day. A rhino, you say? One a day? Every day?
Well, I think perhaps in the circumstances I should make it 1.5 rhino per day, plus any out-of-pocket expenses, of course.
The wizard rallied magnificently.
That will be fine, he said.
Twoflower reached into his pouch and took out a large round gold object, glanced at it for a moment, and slipped it back.
Rincewind didn't get a chance to see it properly.
I think, said the tourist, that I'd like a little rest now. It was a long crossing. And then perhaps you would care to call back at noon and we can take a look at the city.
Sure.
Then please be good enough to ask the innkeeper to show me to my room.
Broadman led the way up the wooden steps behind the bar. After a few seconds, the luggage got up and pattered across the floor after them.
Then the wizard looked down at the 6 big coins in his hand. Twoflower had insisted on paying his first 4 days' wages in advance. Blind Hugh nodded and smiled encouragingly. Rincewind snarled at him.
When Rincewind returned to the Broken Drum, he was just in time to collide with a man who came out backwards fast. The stranger's haste was in part accounted for by the spear in his chest.
Rincewind peered around the doorframe.
The dark interior of the drum was a broil of fighting men, quite a number of them in bits.
Rincewind reached the stairway.
He made the stairs in one breathless rush. In the corridor above, he saw the floor in front of him was scattered with bodies. A big black-bearded man with a bloody sword in one hand was trying a door handle.
"Hey!" screamed Rincewind.
The man looked around.
Rincewind drew himself up into a wizardly pose. His hand was flung back.
Asonaitai Kairusha Bialzeblo.
The man hesitated as he waited for the magic. The conclusion that there wasn't going to be any hit him at the same time as Rincewind, whirring wildly down the passage, kicked him sharply in the groin. As he screamed and clutched at himself, the wizard dragged open the door, sprang inside, slammed it behind him, and threw his body against it, panting.
There was Twoflower, sleeping peacefully on the low bed, and there at the foot of the bed was the luggage. Rincewind took a few steps forward. The chest was open. There were bags inside, and in one of them he caught the gleam of gold. For a moment, greed overcame caution, and he reached out gingerly, and was surprised to see a slight tremor in the chest's open lid.
Rincewind!
Twoflower sprang off the bed. My dear chap, right on time. We'll just have lunch, and then I'm sure you've got a wonderful programme lined up for this afternoon.
Rincewind took a deep breath. Let's eat somewhere else. There's been a bit of a fight down below.
A tavern brawl? Why didn't you wake me up?
Well, you see, I...
What?
Rincewind sat down heavily on the bed.
You want to see a fight? Yes, what's wrong with that?
For a start, people get hurt.
Oh, I wasn't suggesting we get involved. I just want to see one, that's all. And some of your famous heroes?
There was a clatter of running feet in the street outside, and a fresh uproar from downstairs. It was followed by a commotion on the stairs. The door was flung open before Rincewind could make a dash for the window. But instead of the greed-crazed villain he expected, he found himself looking into the round, red face of a sergeant of the watch. The watch was always careful not to intervene too soon in any brawl where the odds weren't heavily stacked in their favour. The job carried a pension and attracted a cautious, thoughtful kind of man.
"Everything all right here, then?" the sergeant said.
"Oh, fine," said Rincewind. "Got held up, did you?" The sergeant ignored him.
"This is the foreigner, then?" he inquired.
"We were just leaving," said Rincewind quickly.
He marched out into the corridor. Twoflower followed, and a few seconds later there was a strangling sound from the sergeant as the luggage closed its lid with a snap, stood up, stretched, and marched after them.
Watchmen were dragging bodies out of the room downstairs.
"Who are all these men?"
said Twoflower. "Oh, you know," said Rincewind. And before he could stop himself, some part of his brain that had nothing to do took control of his mouth and added, "Heroes, in fact."
"Really?"
Twoflower had thrown back the lid of the luggage and was hastily pulling out a heavy black cube.
"This is fantastic," he said.
"What's he going on about?"
said the sergeant doubtfully.
"He's pleased you rescued us," said Rincewind.
"I expect you know what this is, don't you?" Twoflower asked. Rincewind stared down at the box. It had a round glass eye protruding from the centre of one face and a lever at the back.
Not wholly. "It's a device for making pictures quickly. Quite a new invention. I'm rather proud of it. But look, these gentlemen might be sort of apprehensive. Could you explain it to them? I'll reimburse them for their time, of course."
"He's got a box with a demon in it that draws pictures," said Rincewind shortly. "Do what the madman says, and he'll give you gold." The watch smiled nervously.
"I'd like you in the picture, Rincewind. That's fine."
Twoflower took out the golden disc that Rincewind had noticed before, squinted at its unseen face for a moment, muttered, "30 seconds should about do it," and said brightly, "Smile, please." Rincewind looked at the tiny square of glass in astonishment. There he was, all right, a tiny figure in perfect colour, standing in front of a group of watchmen whose faces were each frozen in a terrified rictus. A buzz of wordless terror went up from the men around him as they craned over his shoulder to look. Grinning, Twoflower produced a handful of the smaller coins Rincewind now recognised as quarter rhino. He winked at the wizard.
"I had similar problems when I stopped over in the Brown Islands," he said. "They thought the iconograph steals a bit of their souls."
Laughable, isn't it? They lunched at a small eating house near the brass bridge, with the luggage nestling under the table. Twoflower said,
"Tavern fights are pretty common around here, I expect."
"Oh, fairly."
"No doubt fixtures and fittings get damaged."
"You mean like benches and whatnot?"
"Yeah, I suppose so."
"That must be upsetting for the innkeepers.
One of the risks of the job."
Twoflower regarded him thoughtfully.
"I might be able to help there," he said. "Risks are my business."
"I don't believe it."
"Oh, I don't take risks. I assess risks day after day."
"What for?"
"In my language, we call it..."
He said a collection of outlandish syllables.
"In sewer ants," repeated Rincewind.
"It's a funny word. What's it mean?"
"Well, suppose you have a ship loaded with, say, gold bars. It might run into storms or be taken by pirates. You don't want that to happen, so you take out an in sewer ants poly C. I work out the odds against the cargo being lost, based on weather reports and piracy records for the last 20 years. Then I add a bit. Then you pay me some money based on those odds, and then, if the cargo is lost, I reimburse you."
"Reimburse? Pay you the value of your cargo," said Twoflower patiently.
"I get it. It's like a bet, right?"
"A wager? Well, in a way, I suppose."
"And you make money at this in sewer ants?"
"It offers a return on investment, certainly."
In the long afternoon, they toured the city. Rincewind took every opportunity to operate the box. Twoflower was only too pleased to allow this, since that enabled the little man to appear in his own pictures. It was while he was thus engaged in the Plaza of Broken Moons that disaster struck. Twoflower had posed alongside a bewildered charm seller. Rincewind got down on one knee, the better to arrange the picture, and pressed the enchanted lever. The box said,
"It's no good. I've run out of pink."
A hitherto unnoticed door opened in front of his eyes. A small, green and hideously warty humanoid figure leant out, pointed at a colour-encrusted palette in one clawed hand, and screamed at him.
"No pink, see? It's monochrome from now on, friend, all right?
All right, yeah, sure, said Rincewind. In one dim corner of the little box, he thought he could see an easel and a tiny unmade bed.
So long as that's understood,
said the imp and shut the door. Two Flower, Rincewind began, and looked up. Two Flower had vanished. As Rincewind stared at the crowd, there came a gentle prod in the small of his back. Turn without haste, said a voice like black silk, or kiss your kidneys goodbye. Rincewind turned slowly, feeling the point of the sword scrape along his ribs. At the other end of the blade, he recognised Stren Whittle, thief, cruel swordsman, disgruntled contender for the title of worst man in the world, Emor's sidekick.
Hi,
Rincewind said weakly. A few yards away, he noticed a couple of unsympathetic men raising the lid of the luggage and pointing excitedly at the bags of gold. Withel smiled.
I know you, he said. A gutter wizard. What is that thing?
Rincewind became aware that the lid of the luggage was trembling slightly, although there was no wind, and he was still holding the picture box. This? Oh, it makes pictures.
Hey! Just hold that smile, will you?
He backed away quickly and pointed the box. For a moment, Withel hesitated.
What?
He said.
That's fine. Hold it just like that, said Rincewind.
From the luggage, there was a snap and a duet of horrible screams. By the time Withel looked for Rincewind again, he was on the other side of the plaza and still accelerating. Behind him galloped the luggage. Emor's headquarters were in the Leaning Tower at the junction of Rhyme Street and Frost Alley. At midnight, the solitary guard leaning in the shadows looked up at the conjoining planets and wondered idly what change in his fortune they might herald. There was the faintest of sounds, as of a gnat yawning. The guard glanced down and caught the glimmer of moonlight on something lying in the mud a few yards away. He picked it up. The lunar light gleamed on gold. There was a slight sound again, and another coin rolled into the gutter on the other side of the street. By the time he'd picked it up, there was another one, a little way off and still spinning. As he drew level with the opposite alley mouth, some more fell. It was still in its bag. There was an awful lot of it, and Rincewind brought it down heavily onto his head. When the guard came to, he found himself looking up into the wild-eyed face of a wizard who was menacing his throat with a sword. In the darkness, something was gripping his leg.
"Where is he, the rich foreigner?" hissed the wizard. "Quickly!" "I've got him at Broadman's place!"
With only his homemade phrasebook to help him, Twoflower was trying to explain the mysteries of in-sewer ants to Broadman. The fat innkeeper was listening intently, his little black eyes glittering. From the other end of the table, Emor watched. Beside him, Stren Whittle paced up and down. It was strange, but the little man didn't seem to realise the seriousness of his position. He'd been talking for ages to Broadman, and Emor had seen a piece of paper change hands, and Broadman had given the foreigner some coins. It was strange. When Broadman got up and waddled past Emor's chair, the thief master's arm shot out like a steel spring and grabbed the fat man by his apron.
What was all that about, friend?
Nothing, Emor, just private business, like.
There are no secrets between friends, Broadman.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure about it myself, really. It's sort of a bet, see,
said the innkeeper nervously.
In-sewer ants, it's called. It's like a bet that the broken drum won't get burnt down.
Emor laughed. The man must be mad.
He says now he's got the, can't remember the word, begins with a P. It's what you might call the stake money. The people he works for in the Agatian Empire will pay up if the broken drum burns down. Not that I hope it does burn down, the broken drum, I mean. I mean, it's like home to me is the drum.
The door slammed back on its hinges and thudded into the wall.
"Hey, that's my door!"
screamed Broadman. Then he ducked behind the table, a mere shaving of time before a short black dart sped across the room and thunked into the woodwork. Emor moved his hand carefully and poured out another flagon of beer.
"Won't you join me, Zlorf?" he said levelly. "And put that sword away, Strend. Zlorf Flannelfoot is our friend."
The president of the Assassin's Guild spun his short blowgun dexterously and slotted it into its holster in one smooth movement. He strolled down the stairs, followed by a number of assassins. When he was directly in front of Emor, he said,
"I've come for the tourist. Is he that funny-looking one over there?"
"Yes." Zlorf stared at Twoflower, who grinned at him.
"Who is your client, may I ask?" said Emor.
Zlorf held up a hand.
"Please," he protested. "Professional etiquette." "Of course. By the way..."
The door flew open, badly damaging the assassin who was standing beside it.
"Stop doing that!" shrieked Broadman from under his table.
Zlorf and Emor stared up at the figure on the threshold. It was short, fat, and richly dressed. There were a number of tall, big shapes looming behind it.
"Who's that?" said Zlorf. "I know him," said Emor.
"His name's Rupf. He runs the Groaning Platter Tavern down by Brass Bridge. Stren, remove him." Several very large trolls ducked under the doorway and stood on either side of the fat man, blinking in the light. Muscles the size of melons bulged in forearms like flour sacks. Each troll held a double-headed axe between thumb and forefinger.
"What do you want?" said Emor.
"I'm here on behalf of the Guild of Merchants and Traders," said Rupf evenly. "To protect our interests, you might say. Meaning the little man. I'm a vice-guildmaster in charge of tourism, you know."
Emor wrinkled his brow.
"Tourism?"
"Stands to reason," said Rupf. "People robbing and murdering all over the place. What sort of impression are visitors going to take away? You come to see our fine city and you wake up dead in some back alley. How are you going to tell all your friends what a great time you're having? Let's face it, you've got to move with the times."
Zlorf and Emor met each other's gaze.
"We have we?" said Emor. "Then let us move, brother," agreed Zlorf.
In one movement, he brought his blowgun to his mouth and sent a dart hissing towards the nearest troll. That was the start. Wizards, even failed wizards, have, in addition to rods and cones in their eyeballs, the tiny octagons that enable them to see into the far octarine, the basic colour, of which all other colours are merely pale shadows impinging on normal four-dimensional space. And those who are sensitive to radiations in the far octarine, the eighth colour, the pigment of the imagination, can see things others can't. Thus it was that Rincewind, hurrying through the bazaars of Moorpork with the luggage trundling behind him, jostled a tall, dark figure, turned to deliver a few suitable curses, and beheld death. It had to be death. No one else went around with empty eye sockets. And, of course, the scythe over one shoulder was another clue.
"Rincewind,"
Death said, in tones as deep and heavy as the slamming of leaden doors far underground. Said Rincewind.
"Why are you here?"
Why not?" said Rincewind.
"I have an appointment with thee this very night."
"Oh, no, not..."
"I was expecting to meet thee in Sephopololis."
"But that's 500 miles away."
"I could lend you a very fast horse."
"No!"
"It won't hurt a bit."
"No!" Rincewind turned and ran. Death watched him go and shrugged. Short Street, Moorpork, is in fact one of the longest in the city. The broken drum is so placed that it looks down the full length of the street. Inside, the war was going well.
At the furthermost end of Short Street, a dark oblong rose on hundreds of tiny legs and started to run. By the time it was halfway up the street, it was moving arrow fast. A darker shadow inched its way along one of the walls of the drum, a few yards from the two trolls who were guarding the door. One of the trolls tapped his colleague on the shoulder. He pointed down the starlit street. Rincewind darted from his hiding place, turned, and hurled his burden through the drum's nearest window. The bag arced across the room, turning slowly in the air, and burst on the edge of a table. A moment later, gold coins were rolling across the floor, spinning, glittering. 60 men and 12 trolls froze in mid-grope. Outside, there was a sudden crescendo of running feet, and for the last time, the door opened. In fact, it exploded. Door and frame landed on a table, which flew into splinters. It was then that the frozen fighters noticed that there was something else in the pile of wood. It was a box, shaking itself madly to free itself of the smashed timber around it. Rincewind appeared in the ruined doorway, hurling another of his gold grenades. It smashed into a wall, showering coins. Down in the cellar, Broadman looked up, muttered to himself, and carried on with his work. His entire supply of candles had already been strewn on the floor, mixed with his store of kindling wood. Now he was attacking a barrel of lamp oil.
"In sewer ants," he muttered.
Oil gushed out and swirled around his feet. Withel stormed across the floor, his face a mask of rage. Rincewind took careful aim and caught the thief full in the chest with a bag of gold. Emor was shouting and pointing an accusing finger. A raven swooped down from its perch in the rafters and dived at the wizard, talons open and gleaming. At about the halfway point, the luggage leapt from its bed of splinters, gaped briefly in midair, and snapped shut. It landed lightly. Rincewind saw its lid open again, just far enough for a tongue, large as a palm leaf, red as mahogany, to lick up a few errant feathers. At the same time, the giant candle wheel fell from the ceiling, plunging the room into gloom. Rincewind, coiling himself like a spring, gave a standing jump and grasped a beam, swinging himself up into the relative safety of the roof with a strength that amazed him. Rincewind rolled. For a moment he thought Withel was going to spit him where he lay. But it was worse than that. He was waiting for him to get up.
"I see you have a sword, wizard," he said quietly. "I suggest you rise, and we shall see how well you use it."
Rincewind stood up as slowly as he dared. "You know that wizards can't be killed by edged weapons?" Withel smiled coldly.
"So I've heard," he said. "I look forward to putting it to the test."
As his sword went back, the sullen glow that had been growing in the doorway of the broken drum flickered, dimmed, and erupted into a roaring fireball that sent the walls billowing outward and carried the roof 100 feet into the air. Withel stared at the boiling flames unnerved. Flames were racing along the rooftops on either side of the street. Rincewind grabbed Twoflower's arm and dragged him down the street. Something was puzzling Rincewind. "I'm sure all the candles went out," he said. "So how did the drum catch fire?"
"I don't know," replied Twoflower. "It'll be a blow for old Broadman. Still, he was wise. I've still got the rhino he paid as his first premium."
Rincewind didn't know the meaning of the word premium, but his mind was working fast.
"You ensured the drum. You bet Broadman it wouldn't catch fire."
"Oh, yes, standard valuation, 200 rhino. Why do you ask?"
Rincewind turned and stared at the flames racing towards them, and wondered how much of Ankh-Morpork could be bought for 200 rhino. Quite a large piece, he decided. Bravd looked at the weasel and raised his eyebrows.
"And that's it," said Rincewind. "The luggage caught out with us. Don't ask me how. Is there any more wine?"
The weasel picked up the empty wineskin.
"I think you've had just about enough wine this night," he said.
He turned away
and swung himself into the saddle of the horse that Bravd was holding. A few moments later, the two heroes were just specks under a cloud of dust. Rincewind stared muzzily at the recumbent tourist. A stray thought, wandering through the dimensions in search of a mind to harbour it, slid into his brain.
"Here's another fine mess you got me into," he moaned, and slumped backwards.
The Sending of Eight. The Discworld offers sights far more impressive than those found in universes built by creators with less imagination but more mechanical aptitude. Perhaps the most magnificent sight is the Hub. There, a spire of green ice 10 miles high rises through the clouds and supports at its peak the realm of Dun Manifestin, the abode of the Disc Gods. On this particular day, Blind Io, by dint of constant vigilance the chief of the gods, sat with his chin in his hand and looked at the gaming board on the red marble table in front of him. Blind Io had got his name because where his eye socket should have been, there was nothing but two areas of blank skin. His eyes, of which he had an impressively large number, led a semi-independent life of their own. Several were currently hovering above the table. The gaming board was a carefully carved map of the Discworld, overprinted with squares. A number of beautifully modelled playing pieces were now occupying some of the squares. An onlooker would, for example, have recognised in two of them the likenesses of Bravd and the Weasel. Still in the game were Io, Offler, the crocodile god, Zephyrus, the god of slight breezes, Fate, and the Lady. There was an air of concentration around the board, now that the lesser players had been removed from the game. Blind Io took up the dice box, which was a skull whose various orifices had been stoppered with rubies, and with several of his eyes on the lady, he rolled 3 fives. She smiled. This was the nature of the lady's eyes. They were bright green, lacking iris or pupil, and they glowed from within. The room was silent. She scrabbled in her box of pieces, and from the very bottom produced a couple that she set down on the board with 2 decisive clicks. The rest of the players, as one god, craned forward to peer at them.
"A renegade wizard and thumb fought of Clark," said Offler, the crocodile god, hindered as usual by his tusks. "Well, really."
With one claw, he pushed a pile of bone-white tokens into the centre of the table. The lady nodded slightly. She picked up the dice cup and held it as steady as a rock, yet all the gods could hear the cubes rattling about inside. And then she sent them bouncing across the table. 6, 3, 5. Something was happening to the 5, however. Battered by the chance collision of several billion molecules, the die flipped onto a point, spun gently, and came down 7. Blind Io picked up the cube and counted the sides.
"Come on," he said wearily. "Play fair."
Twoflower was a tourist, the first ever seen on the Discworld. Tourist, Rincewind had decided, meant idiot. As they rode leisurely through the time-scented bee-humming air, Rincewind pondered on the experiences of the last few days. While the little foreigner was obviously insane, he was also generous. Rincewind rather liked him. Disliking him would be like kicking a puppy. Currently, Twoflower was showing a great interest in the theory and practice of magic. Rincewind was trying to explain that magic had once been wild and lawless, but had been tamed back in the mists of time by the Olden Ones. He went on to add that some of the ancient magic could still be found in its raw state, recognisable to the initiated by the eightfold shape it made in the crystalline structure of space-time. There was the metal octyron, for example, and the gas octogen. Both radiated dangerous amounts of raw enchantment. Rincewind
turned in his saddle and glanced at Two Flowers' luggage, which was currently ambling along on its little legs, occasionally snapping its lid at butterflies. There was a faint sound, hardly louder than the noise of the bees in the rosemary by the road. It had a curiously bony quality, as of rolling skulls or a whirling dice box. Rincewind peered around. There was no one nearby. There came a slight breeze that grew and went in the space of a few heartbeats. It left the world unchanged, save in a few interesting particulars. There was now, for example, a 5-metre-tall mountain troll standing in the road. It was exceptionally angry. This was partly because trolls generally are, in any case, but it was exacerbated by its sudden and instantaneous teleportation from its lair in the Ramarok Mountains 3,000 miles away. So it bared its fangs and charged. Rincewind drew his sword and with a smooth overarm throw completely failed to hit the troll. The blade plunged on into the heather at the side of the track. There was the faintest of sounds, like the rattle of old teeth. The sword struck a boulder concealed in the heather. It sprang up like a leaping salmon, and in mid-ricochet plunged deeply into the back of the troll's grey neck. The creature grunted, and with one swipe of a claw, gouged a wound in the flank of Two Flowers' horse, which screamed and bolted into the trees. The troll spun around and made a grab for Rincewind. Then its sluggish nervous system brought it the message that it was dead. "Ah," thought Rincewind, as his horse reared in terror. It staggered two-legged across the road, and then screaming, turned and galloped into the woods.
"Rincewind!"
The long aisles of trees threw Two Flowers' voice from side to side and eventually tossed it back to him unheeded. He sat down on a rock and tried to think. He was lost. His luggage was missing. It was also starting to rain. He squirmed uncomfortably on the damp stone and tried to look on the bright side. For example, during its mad dash, his plunging horse had burst through some bushes and disturbed a she-bear with her cubs, but had gone on before the bear could react. Then it had suddenly been galloping over the sleeping bodies of a large wolf pack, and again its mad speed had been such that the furious yelping had been left far behind. Nevertheless, the day was wearing on, and perhaps it would be a good idea, Two Flower thought, not to hang about in the open. Perhaps there was a... He racked his brains trying to remember what sort of accommodation forests traditionally offered. Perhaps there was a gingerbread house or something. The stone really was uncomfortable. Two Flower looked down, and for the first time noticed the strange carving. It looked like a spider. Or was it a squid? Moss and lichens rather blurred the precise details, but they didn't blur the runes carved below it. They said, "Traveller, the hospitable temple of Bel Shamharoth lies 1,000 paces hubwards." Now, this was strange, Two Flower realised, because although he could read the message, the actual letters were completely unknown to him. Somehow, the message was arriving in his brain without the tedious necessity of passing through his eyes. He stood up and untied his horse from a sapling. He wasn't sure which way the hub lay, but there seemed to be an old track of sorts leading between the trees. About 3 miles away, a failed wizard was hanging by his hands from a high branch in a beech tree. This was the end result of 5 minutes of crowded activity. First, an enraged she-bear had barged through the undergrowth and taken the throat out of his horse with one swipe of her paw. Then, as Rincewind had fled the carnage, he'd run into a glade in which a number of irate wolves were milling about. His instructors at Unseen University, who despaired of Rincewind's inability to master levitation, would have been amazed at the speed with which he reached and climbed the nearest tree without apparently touching it. Now, there was just the matter of the snake. It was large and green and wound itself along the branch with reptilian patience. Rincewind wondered if it was poisonous, then chided himself for asking such a silly question. Of course it would be poisonous. "What are you grinning for?" he asked the figure on the next branch.
"I can't help it," said Death. "Now would you be so kind as to let go?" I can't hang around all day.
I can, said Rincewind defiantly. The wolves, clustered around the base of the tree, looked up with interest at their next meal, talking to himself.
It won't hurt, said Death.
Rincewind noticed another branch crossing his dangerously narrowing one a few feet away. If he could just reach it. He swung himself forward, one hand outstretched. The branch, already bending, didn't break. It simply made a wet little sound and twisted. Rincewind found that he was now hanging on to the end of a tongue of bark and fibre, lengthening as it peeled away from the tree. He looked down, and with a sort of fatal satisfaction, realised that he would land right on the biggest wolf. His elbow nudged something. It was the tree trunk. The strip had carried him right to the end of the branch. But there were no other branches. The smooth bark beside him offered no handholds. It offered hands, though. Two were even now thrusting through the mossy bark beside him, slim hands, green as young leaves. Then a shapely arm followed, and then the Hamadryad leant right out and grasped the astonished wizard firmly and drew him into the tree. The solid bark parted like a mist, closed like a clam. Blind Eo pushed his stack of chips across the table and strode out. A few demigods tittered. At least Offler had taken the loss of a perfectly good troll with precise, if somewhat reptilian, grace. The lady's last opponent shifted his seat until he faced her across the board.
Lord, she said politely. Lady, he acknowledged. Their eyes met.
Fate was a taciturn god. His were features that a maiden would confidently proffer a glass of small beer to, should they appear at her back door. His was a face a kindly youth would gladly help over a stile. Except for his eyes, of course. The lady laid 21 white chips on the table. Then from her robe, she took another chip, silvery and translucent, and twice the size of the others. The soul of a true hero always finds a better rate of exchange, and is valued highly by the gods. Fate raised an eyebrow.
And no cheating, lady, he said. But who could cheat fate, she asked. He shrugged. No one. Yet everyone tries. The lady smiled. I believe I felt you giving me a little assistance against the others. But of course. So that the end game could be the sweeter, lady. And now...
He reached into his gaming box and brought forth a piece, setting it down on the board with a satisfied air. The watching deities gave a collective sigh. Even the lady was momentarily taken aback. It was certainly ugly. It seemed to be all suckers and tentacles. And mandibles, the lady observed, and one great eye. Fate scooped the dice into the box and then glanced up.
Unless, he said, you wish to resign. She shook her head.
Play, she said. Rincewind knew what was inside trees. Wood, sap, possibly squirrels, not a palace. Still, the cushions underneath him were definitely softer than wood. The wine in the wooden cup beside him was much tastier than sap, and there could be absolutely no comparison between a squirrel and the girl sitting before him, clasping her knees and watching him thoughtfully, unless mention was made of certain hints of furriness. The girl was green, flesh green. Rincewind could be absolutely certain about that, because all she was wearing was a medallion around her neck. Her long hair had a faintly mossy look about it. She had said nothing. Apart from indicating the couch and offering him the wine, she'd done no more than sit watching him, occasionally rubbing a deep scratch on her arm. Rincewind hurriedly recalled that a dryad was so linked to her tree that she suffered wounds in sympathy. "Sorry about that," he said quickly. "It was just an accident. I mean, there were these wolves and..."
"You had to climb my tree, and I rescued you,"
said the dryad smoothly.
"How lucky for you, and for your friend, perhaps."
"Friend?"
"The little man with the magic box,"
said the dryad. "Oh, sure, him.
said Rincewind vaguely. "Yeah, I hope he's okay."
"He needs your help."
"Usually does."